The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Book of Serenity. Yan Yang's Thing. The pointer. Playing with reflections, struggling for the form, you don't recognize that the form is the source of the reflection. Raising your voice to stop an echo, you don't know the voice is the root of the echo. If it's not riding an ox, looking for an ox, then it's using a wedge to remove a wedge. How can you avoid these extremes? Main case. Venerable Yan Yang asked Zhaozhou, when not a single thing is brought, then what? Zhaozhou said, put it down. Yan Yang said, if I don't bring a single thing, what should I put down? Zhaozhou said, then carry it out. Hongzhi's verse. Not prepared for meticulous action, he loses to the first to move. Realizing himself the coarseness of his mind, he's embarrassed at bumping his head. When the game is ended, the axe handles rotted at the side. Clean and purify the ordinary bones to play with the immortals. Zhaozhou is one of those kind of extraordinary teachers. He lived to be 120. He came into the Dharma in his teens, came to realization, I think, when he was 18, studied for many, many years with Nanquan, his teacher, went traveling, I don't know, for a couple of decades, I think, when he was already quite advanced in age, and then settled down in the town of Zhaozhou and taught for the rest of his life. And through all of that, he only had one successor. I guess it would be hard to satisfy such a person. And that was Yan Yang. And according to the record, Yan Yang had no successors, and there's very little known about him. So this is one of the few recorded dialogues. Playing with reflection, struggling for the form, you don't recognize it. The form is the source of the reflection. It's kind of like, you know, walking along and seeing a shadow and being frightened by it and trying to escape it. Have you ever seen a cat walk in front of a mirror and stop and look? Right? It hisses back. Riding an ox, looking for an ox. There are a lot of ways of speaking about this. Sitting by the river, calling out in thirst, carrying this precious jewel, claiming poverty, possessing Buddha nature, feeling insecure, incapable. How many ways to convey? It's such a... What Buddhism is teaching is really, you know, using a vehicle that we call Buddhism, but it's really teaching something that is completely universal because it's just utterly human. Buddha nature has nothing to do, in a sense, with Buddhism. It's just our nature. It's the nature of everything. And so in that way, it's timeless, exists in every time and place, every culture, whether we realize it or not. And yet, not realizing it, realizing it is a very personal experience. We're each having our own particular experience of everything. Sitting on this mat, the posture of a Buddha all week, seeking peace, a clear mind, freedom from our entanglements, to be alive. I was remarking to somebody earlier, the book that I've drawn on several times over the years, Deep Survival, I think, author's name is last name, Gonzalez, can't remember his first name. And the whole book is a study of, his father was, I think, in World War II, probably, was an aviator, was shot down. He was the only soul, he was a sole survivor. And his son, the author of this book, was gripped by this question of why did he survive? And so he made this study of people who'd been in all kinds of impossible situations, out in the middle of the ocean, in the mountains, lost, people who shouldn't have survived, who were with other people who didn't survive. And he studied them and he wanted to know why. Why this one? What are the common threads? And one of the many things that he talked about in studying all these different people, these cases, is that in each case, the person who survived at a certain point decided that they were not going to be rescued. They weren't stopped waiting to be rescued. And he said at that point, they were no longer waiting to be rescued, but they were just simply living. And they were doing whatever they needed to do to live. Kind of like this. A little less, I was going to say dramatic, but I don't know, maybe you would disagree. So how can we avoid these extremes? Turning away from oneself, turning away from others, or getting caught in ourselves, getting caught in our idea of others. And so here this student comes to Zhao Zhou and says, when not a single thing is brought forth, then what? And the footnote says, this is still beyond him, that there's something going on that is not yet clear, not yet seen. And Zhao Zhou said, put it down. Very simple, very direct. When there's not a single thing that is brought. So the Buddha realized that our attachments, our self-clinging, is sort of the operative force that causes our suffering. Underlying that, sort of dependent on our attachments, are dependent on what he called our view. What we think is going on, what we believe in, the assumptions we make, the basis, sort of the rational basis, even though it might not be in our mind, we might not be aware. But it's the clinging, the grasping that ultimately binds us or binds us in all kinds of ways. And so we are putting that burden down. We are releasing, relinquishing, giving that up. Not just once, but again and again, 100,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, thinking arises. And so here, Yan Yang says, there's nothing more to be put down, nothing more to be that I can bring. What now? It's like after having carried a heavy burden for so long, for so many years, finally putting it down. It's like the body has adapted to that, so it still feels the weight. It bends under the weight that's no longer there. The muscles have all realigned to hold that weight. They're still gripped. There's a constant pressure of that, the presence of that that we've gotten used to. And now it's sort of still there. Maybe it's sort of like when they say that somebody's limb has been amputated, there's sort of a ghost limb that's still there, that the mind is still experiencing the presence of that. There's a sense of ourself carrying that burden. I have carried it. I am someone who has carried it. That has been my burden. And now there's this self that is no longer carrying that. Who am I now? So of course there can be attachments that we're not even aware of. Either because we're not interested. It's not our interest. We're not practicing. It's not in our lexicon. It's not something we're aware of, or thinking about, or concerned about. But then there is being concerned, wanting to know, and having attachments we're just not aware of. We don't see them, or we don't see them as attachments. We don't recognize them. You know, one of the sort of core teachings of the Buddha that is sort of our what we need to be developing, our responsibility as practitioners, is being able to understand more and more and discern the difference between what is wholesome and what is not, what is skillful and what is not, what is working well on our behalf and what is not. And that we have to develop our own understanding of that, capacity of that. And it's not just based on our own relative sense of what I want, what I like, what's comfortable, but actually it's based in the sense of my aspiration. What do I want this life to be? What is the ground of it? And so there is holding on. And then there is relinquishing. And we use this language, right? That we hold on to something, we attach to something, we cling, we grasp these different ways. And that in the teaching of the dependent origination, there's when the senses come into contact, there's a sensory experience that is either positive or negative, usually, can be neutral. And then there's desire, right? And there's grasping, and when that gets stronger and stronger, it becomes clinging. And so there is holding on, there is letting go, there's the awareness of attaching, the awareness of letting go, there's practicing, right? We get lots of opportunities to practice that, right? Uncountable opportunities. And a lot of what we let go of, and it's not that we've never done that before. We've let go of things in our life. We may not have even been aware that that's what we're doing. And much of what we let go of as we become more aware of it is very trivial, rather superficial. Doesn't mean much to us, even though we can keep going back to it. It's fairly light, and so we let go of it, and it passes. And there are other things that are not like that, that are quite heavy, that have really dug themselves into us, have really become a deep part of our history, our memories, our embodiment, our identity. There's wanting to let go, and at the same time, not quite. There's really sincerely wanting to let go, and on subtle levels, still reaching back. And so recognizing all of this is very important as practitioners of a path of non-attachment, right? To become proficient, rather adept. And that doesn't mean to have no clinging, but to develop our capacity, our skill, if you will, at this. And that's why the things that are light teach us how to recognize those attachments and let go of them in a light way, those things that are much more significant. We learn how to recognize and let go of things in a much more significant way. And the greater the attachment, the more the suffering, usually. They go hand in hand. But at the same time, the greater the transformation, the greater the release. You know, it's sort of like a pressure cooker. You know, if you release the steam after just a little bit, it's just a pfft. You know, it hasn't built up. But if you wait until it's fully pressured, it's a big release, right? And attachment, I've spoken of this recently, I think, attachment is part of the Abhidharma teachings of the mental factors. And there, which are basically a kind of taxonomy of all of the sort of significant mental, emotional experiences that we have within ourselves that are basically states of mind. Mind and emotion together. And in that teaching of mental factors, attachment is defined as its function is to give rise to suffering. Well, that's pretty clear. Right? That's pretty direct. You know, it's one of the things that I have always really appreciated about Buddhism since my very first encounter with it, was that just plain talking. This is the way it is. You may not like it. And it's not about liking or not liking in a sense. It's just like, this is the way things are, actually. For anyone who is interested. And just this very direct way of speaking, which isn't laden with false optimism or with false pessimism. It's just like, this is the deal. Attachments function, their function is to create suffering. Now, of course, that's not our function in having our attachments. Our function is usually quite the opposite, is to try and get away from our suffering, which many of our attachments do for a little bit, right? They do give us a bit of relief. That's why we keep going back to them, because they work. But they don't last very long, and they work in a very simple way, very superficial way. And so built into our attachments is more attachments. That's what's required to keep the system going. Its function is to give rise to suffering. Attachment exaggerates the positive quality of an object. As I said, we think attachment is going to help us to avoid suffering. But they work just the opposite. And part of their function is that when we're, you know, attracted towards something, so maybe you've had the thought of some fabulous meal you're going to have tomorrow night, or somebody you're going to be with, or something you're going to do. And there's the thought that arises. And in that fantasy, basically, that imagining, the positive aspect of that, what it's going to do for us, can be so much more than it will actually be. It's exaggerated. And of course, that just feeds the desire, feeds the attachment. Yeah, I want that, because it's going to be so good. Right? I remember when I think I was 15, and my friend and I cooked up an idea of going on a cross-country bike trip. We took a train out to Montana, rode for a long time. And beforehand, because I was working all year during high school to pay for this, to finance it for myself. And so I was thinking about it, I was dreaming, I was looking at maps, I was, you know, the Rockies, and you know, and it was just, and so when I got there, I was almost exhausted, right? I spent so much time thinking about it. And I realized, I wasn't practicing yet, but I realized I had done something. I had gotten so hooked in my own perfect trip, perfect vision of what it was going to be, that when I got there, it was still pretty great. But there was this, like, thing. Exaggeration. And the teachings say that the different kinds of attachment is we can crave for what we don't have. That's familiar. We can be afraid of being separated from something that we do have. Could be something, could be someone, could be a situation, could be anything. So craving, basically, for something that we want. And then there's the craving for existence, which often does bring fear. But the craving for existence to be, and that's the basic force that in the teachings of rebirth pushes consciousness forward into another lifetime, because it's craving, it's grasping. That's why when the Buddha was enlightened and really broke that cycle, he said, this will be my last birth. That cycle of clinging was broken. And then there's craving for non-existence, to have something that is unpleasant or difficult cease to exist, to go away. In an extreme case, it could be to wish to cease to exist ourselves. Asanga, an ancient Indian master, described it this way. I'll put it in the first person. So first, I'm consumed by the fire of craving. Right? It comes up, it's very strong in me, I feel it, it's a thirst. And will seek the object of my desire. So whatever it is that I'm thirsty for, hungry for, that I'm craving, that object is now in my mind. In seeking that object, I will experience the pain of being tired by this pursuit. But often, it's worth it. Right? Because we've got this thing that we're going to get. So it's worth. We'll work hard. We'll go through a lot for something that we want, right? We'll endure a lot. And so he says, but we will experience pain, but we may not even recognize it as pain because our sights are set on our object. Then he says, if I fail to gain the object, then I'm tormented by this. Yeah, frustration, discouragement. I get angry. Life's not fair. I'm a screw up. I'm tormented by that. So I suffer from the pursuit itself and its pointlessness, right? It wasn't successful. Even if I obtain the object, he says, much effort is required to protect what has been gained. So now I've got it. You know, it's like when you buy a new car, it's like the first scratch. Oh, right. Right? We want to protect it. Sometimes you see people parking, you know, and taking up two lots so nobody can get close to the car, right? So much effort is required to protect what has been gained. So all of that energy that's gone into pursuit for the desire, we've obtained it. But now the desire is sort of hampered, right? Because we can't fully enjoy it because what if I lose it? And thus the pain of trying to protect it. When enjoying what has been obtained, then the fire of attachment is internally consuming. So in that enjoyment, he says, it's internally consuming. And then when the object decays, as it will, another scratch, the first collision, right? Then there will be sorrow and thoughts about how it used to be, right? Or how the next one's going to be. The Buddha said, and so that's the cycle, right? That's basically samsara. It just repeats and repeats because the thing that we're seeking will not be satisfied in any ultimate sense by our efforts. And so it built into it is, we could say, call it failure. The Buddha said is disappointment, dissatisfaction, dukkha. The Buddha said, what is clinging? What is the origin of clinging? What is the cessation of clinging? What is the way leading to the cessation of clinging? So the other day I talked about the Eightfold Path and how, and the Four Noble Truths, and how the Buddha would often talk about different aspects of the teachings from within the Four Noble Truths. So that's exactly what he's doing here. So to understand clinging from the point of view of its origin, right? What is it? Or rather, what is it? Just to recognize that it exists. And what is its origin? How does it arise? How does it come to cessation? How do we free ourselves? And what is the path to that? Then he said, there are four kinds of clinging. Clinging to sensual pleasures, which is the low-hanging fruit. Clinging to views, right? Our opinions, our views, our beliefs. Clinging to rules and observances. It's very important for us to appreciate that within a tradition, you know, that has a tradition. So there are ways we practice. There are ways we do things. We bow to our seats. We offer incense. There are instruments. We do services, right? And we practice that as a way of developing mindfulness, as a way of creating unity within the Sangha, as a way of meeting all of our preferences. I'd really rather do it that way. Meeting our views, this is stupid. It functions in so many different ways. And one of the ways it can function is to create suffering when we cling to it. And so the Buddha said from the very beginning, there is clinging to rules and observances, which is another way of saying, don't do that. Use them. He had lots of rules, hundreds of rules for the monastics. But what he's saying here is their function is to alleviate suffering, not to create more. Clinging to views, rules, and observances, and then clinging to a doctrine or a notion of self. With the arising of craving, there's the arising of clinging. With the cessation of craving, there's the cessation of clinging. The way leading to the cessation of clinging is the Eightfold Path. It said that there are 10, I think this is also within the Abhidharma, there are 10 bases of clinging, sort of basic sort of, you know, things that we cling to. The aggregates, right? That I talked about this a little bit the other day. Form, our sensations, our feelings, our perceptions, our mental formations, which we, discrimination is how we translate that in our chanting of the Heart Sutra, which, and mental formations basically includes intention, effort, discrimination, joy, a whole host of sort of mental experiences and activities that follow after a perception of something and then consciousness, so that each of those we can cling to. Our views, things that we haven't yet obtained, things that we already obtained, just as I spoke about, already enjoyed past things. So how much time was dedicated this week to remembering past things that you enjoyed, right? And in that is, you know, that's the power of a mental image. We bring forth a mental image and we have an actual experience. It brings forth emotions, it can be uplifting, we can get excited, it can make us feel good, and we're just making it up. That's how powerful the mind is. Indulgent behavior, we can cling to that. We can cling to children and loved ones. Of course, anything that we love. To this Zendo, to robes, to a raksu, to the Dharma, to our possessions we can cling. We can cling to craving for the continuation of something. We're in the midst of something, we want it to continue, we don't want it to end. Cling to non-existence, already spoke about that. And so again, when do we practice non-attachment? Whenever there's attachment. That's why we have to become adept, more adept, at recognizing when there's attachment. How do we know when there's attachment? Because there's suffering. And so part of recognizing that is all of the ways that what dukkha is appears to us, because it isn't always, you know, a terrible experience. It can be very, very slight. It can be very minor. It can be something that we don't even recognize as something that is a state of dis-ease, either because it's so subtle or because we've just become so familiar with it. And so being non-attached doesn't mean to be bereft or barren of things. This is one of the ways it's misunderstood. Of course, there are many unwholesome, unskillful things that we want to, you know, we don't need to keep bringing them into our lives. It just means to not cling. Non-attachment just means to not cling, which is really clinging to our idea of something, to the exaggerated quality of what we think it's going to do for us. The contentment, the fulfillment, the meaning, the sense of worthiness. And so when Yan Yang says, when not a single thing is brought, what then? And Xiaozhou says, put it down. And the footnote to that says, the robe and shirt sticking to the body. Understand that you should shed them. Right? It's like that. That's one of the ways of describing attachment, is that it's sticky, right? It's sticky. You let it go and there it is again. It's like you can't quite shake it off, right? It has that sticky quality. When we let go of something and it just drops away, it's not very sticky. So we should put it down if we want to stop giving rise to the function of our suffering. But if the student brings nothing, as Yang Yang said, then why does Xiaozhou say, put it down? Why does he say that? And so Yang Yang asks, if I don't bring a single thing, what should I put down? And the footnote says, people don't know their own faults. oxen don't know the magnitude of their strength. Right? This is one of the most difficult aspects of practice, is seeing, studying the self, seeing the self for what it is. We're so accustomed. We've been living with ourselves longer than anybody, right? And in every moment. And we become so acclimated and adjusted and adaptive to this self and to all of its functioning. And not only that, but that we've built a whole world of view and understanding and logic and rationale to that. And so, yeah, it's hard to know those things that we are trying to bring our attention to, that we can free ourselves up. And thus, we have to sit. We have to really sit and carefully study and examine and just, in a sense, sit down, open your mind, and the self will keep showing itself to us. And because we don't take an agenda into practice, into sitting, but just to do our root practice, what arises in each moment, in a sense, there's a kind of honesty to it, because you haven't willed it to be. So it's accurately reflecting what we're actually experiencing in this moment, right? Before our opinions. Which means that's the moment to free ourselves. In a sense, that arising is the gift of, oh, this is your opportunity. The attachment is saying, this is your opportunity. Do you want to keep me hanging around? Do you want to make me a little stronger? I'd like that. Do what you did before. Yeah, let's do that again. Or something else. There's a call where Master Bhatsu says, if you have a stick, I'll give you one. If you don't have a stick, I'll take it away. It's quite a beautiful teaching, right? Because it, you know, makes the mind a little crazy. What is he talking about? So obviously he's not saying that so that we can figure out something. He's speaking more directly. And so this is training. This is such an important thing to understand about training. That we make, training is intended to create a conducive environment to train, to do all of this, which doesn't mean to make it overly comfortable. It just means to create an environment in which yourself will keep showing up in small ways and in large ways. And how can we ensure that that's going to happen? We invite some other people into the room. Right? We create a schedule. We voluntarily agree to follow a schedule. There's a lot that we renounce. Right? We give up control over certain things. And then when upset, irritation, annoyance, judgment, distress arises, the function of attachment is to create suffering. Bingo! You've gotten what you wanted. Okay? We didn't know it was going to feel like that. Right? No, I don't want that. I just want to be free of my attachments. Please. Thank you. I mean, when I would hear my teacher talk about this, I thought, I am all in. Yeah. Until it would arise. And it's like, no, not this. And I wouldn't even make the connection between what was happening then and what I had so sincerely, you know, grasped when he was teaching. Right? No, he was talking about something else. But if I don't bring a single thin, Yang Yang said, then what should I put down? And Zhao Zhou says, then carry it out. What else could he do? What else could he say? Not knowing is knowing something, nothing to let go of. Is something to hold on to. Nothing remaining is a trace of something remaining. To say, when not a single thing is brought, then what? Is already displaying that there are still things to be put down. So Zhao Zhou says, then carry it out. And what's so beautiful about this is it makes it very clear. The question is asked, the teacher responds. The student rebuffs, but how could I? And the teacher gives it back to the student again. Very well, then carry it out. It's yours. It's yours to put down. It's yours to carry further. No one can hold on or attach but ourselves. It's just a basic, simple truth. No one can let go but we ourselves. It's just a simple, basic truth. Being aware of our attachments is very important, and it's not enough. We can be very aware and continue to cling. And so we must actually release our hold, which is in the mind. It's the mind's clinging. And then we do that again, and then we do that again, and then we do it again. And each time, in incremental, in a sense, very subtle ways, often very subtle, because the letting go is slight, the mind is opening up that muscle of attachment, the view underlying it, the habit, all of it, the functioning, the creation of our own suffering, and the trust in that. All of that is shifting, shifting, shifting. In the moment of our clinging, in a sense, we're taking refuge in that. We're elevating that to a higher position. We're making that the more important thing in that moment, just by our actions. That's what I want. I'm a Dharma practitioner. I understand non-attachment. I'm good at letting go, but I want this. So I would say, okay, own it. Actually, just own it. If I don't see that, then on it goes. But if I do see that, to actually say, I am choosing this, is a nice way of taking responsibility, and it might change something. Because we can be aware and not at the same time. We can be practicing and kind of slipping by at the same time. And that's just what we're made of, right? But as we keep, you know, if you think of right effort, as we keep sort of tilting the balance from the preponderance of the attachments, you know, to more heavily weighing the non-attachments, in the sense that that's becoming more active, that's becoming more trusted. Yeah, it's still, the habits are still going to show themselves. So we shouldn't be afraid. We shouldn't think, oh, this is still happening. Right? Because that's predicated on the assumption that at some point I will never attach again. Maybe. But don't, you know, turn that into another attachment. Hongzhi says, not prepared for meticulous action, it loses to the first to move, realizing the coarseness of mind, embarrassed at bumping the head. Meticulous effort, meticulous practice, right? It doesn't mean practice with attachment. It's like, doesn't mean being fussy. You know, there's the story of the tea master who was preparing for some high official to come for a tea ceremony, very high ceremony. And he had his attendant sweep all the fall autumn leaves out of the garden. So it was beautiful. And then right before the official showed up, the tea master went out and shook the tree. Some leaves came down. Meticulous effort. Attentive, careful, mindful, wakeful. When the game is ended, the axe handle is rotted at his side. There's a story of somebody who was wandering in the woods and they came upon four kids who were playing chess, and they gave the person something to eat. that really put them at their ease, made them feel totally settled and calm. And the next thing they knew, the children were gone from playing chess, and the axe handle that was by their side had rotted away. They went home, and decades had passed. Meticulous effort when we're not outside, when we're not keeping time, when we're not measuring. Clean and purify the ordinary bones to play with the immortals. I was trying to find Dada Roshi's memorial poem for Allen Ginsberg. Do you remember that? Dim bones, dim bones. That's all I can remember. It was a great poem, but I couldn't find it. Sorry. Clean and purify the ordinary bones to play with the immortals. The comment to that says, head light, ears, eyes clear. The head is light, the eyes are clear. The bones are clean. One of the reasons that the Buddha is held in such high regard within our tradition is because while he had teachers, he did not have teachers of a Buddha Dharma. And so he came to his enlightenment. He practiced in such a way that needed to be done to be able to enlighten his mind without a teacher. Everyone following the Buddha Shakyamuni had a teacher. And so even though many, many over the years have come to enlightenment, have realized themselves, have liberated themselves in small and large ways, the Buddha did it just based on his own capacity. And then spent the rest of his life talking about how we can free ourselves. That's what this whole week has been about. And so let's practice it all the way through. You know, one of the important elements of Zazen, of training, is that each thing we do has a clear beginning and a clear ending. And that's so from the beginning to end, we're carrying that practice all the way through. And then when it ends, then we step into the next practice. So that we're not muddying. We're not here, but actually we're there. But we're not there. We're not here either. And so let's practice this remaining hours of session this way. We're here. This is all there is. What else there is will appear at the right time. And so that we're really in this, staying with this all the way through. Headlight, eyes clear.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.